Most of you are probably familiar with the red imported fire ant, Solanopsis invicta. Today what I'm going to try to do is present an overview and a brief synthesis of some of the attempts to model the predicted range expansion of this species given the current climate and also various scenarios of climate change. This species builds earthen mounds in open sunny areas. It often prefers disturbed areas. It migrates its brood vertically in the soil column for the purpose of thermal regulation. And this is an area where, on the slide for example, you can see it's reached fairly high densities, which is often common. This species has a number of negative impacts where it's been introduced, and I'm not going to go over these in detail. This is all well documented in the literature. It's considered to be one of the world's worst invasive ant species. It's native to South America, the region that's shaded here on the map. And it's hemmed in by some other Solanopsis fire ant species, basically all around this perimeter. So it might actually have a larger distribution if there weren't these other Solanopsis fire ants competing with it in South America. It's been spread over quite a bit of the world already by humans. It likes to travel around in the sorts of things that humans like to transport around the world. It was introduced into the United States in the 1930s to the port of Mobile, Alabama, and since it's spread to a large portion of the southeastern United States, and it's made the jump to the west coast as well. It's in many of the islands in the Bahamas and the Caribbean. It was first discovered in Puerto Rico in 1982, and it's continuing to spread there even now. It was found in Australia in 2001, although it was probably there maybe 6 or 8 years before they actually recognized it as being there. A couple colonies have surfaced in New Zealand at different times and been totally eradicated. It's a fairly substantial population in Taiwan and in mainland China, and now it's gotten into Southeast Asia. So if we want to try to look at where this species can possibly go next or will go as the climate changes, we want to focus on the sort of parameters that are going to limit its spread and survival. And two of the most important ones are temperature and moisture. And we know it can get too cold for this species. This is a hot climate specialist species. It doesn't like cold weather. So as soil temperature becomes colder than 21 degrees C, the colony growth basically becomes negative. And when soil temperature drops below 4 degrees C, the workers just begin to die off. It probably can't become too hot for the species. It may become too hot and dry, but it can't really become too hot in nature per se, as far as we know. As far as the dry threshold, there's this threshold of 510 millimeters of annual precipitation, which you see a lot in the literature and has been used in a lot of the models I'll describe. And this doesn't come from a study like these temperature thresholds, but it comes from some anecdotal data on the distribution of this species in South Texas. And it also ignores the potential importance of the seasonal distribution of precipitation. It probably can't get too wet for the species. Invicta workers will float. They're thought to have evolved in the Pantanal region of South America, which is seasonally inundated. So unless an area is just totally saturated with water all the time, Invicta can probably survive there to some extent. Now, disturbance is also very important. Josh King and Walter Schinkel have some recent research detailing the importance of disturbance for this species. And the models we have now don't really consider this, but future models probably should. These graphs just show the actual quantitative relationships between soil temperature and colony growth rate on the top and worker longevity on the bottom. And this is some work from that was done by Sanford Porter and one of his graduate students that is used in a model by Michael Karzukin et al. And this is a model that I'm going to be talking about in a little more detail right now, actually. There have been some attempts to model the range, potential range of the species for various areas. And I'm not going to talk about those. I'm going to kind of skip ahead to some more recent efforts that have tried to model the global range potential for this species, given the current climate. And this is one that I worked on. We used a simulation model of colony growth that was developed by Michael Karzukin and Sanford Porter that they use for the continental U.S. And we applied that for basically the whole world, except for the polar regions and places where it's obviously too cold. In the model, soil temperature is the primary factor that determines colony growth and survival. Here we have this 510 millimeter annual precipitation threshold that we applied to try to determine whether areas were too dry or too wet. And we got data from over 3,000 weather stations worldwide that we had, you know, good data record. And then the model predicts the potential range based on alate production. So basically, the colony needs to be, each queen needs to be reproducing herself for the species to be able to survive in an area. Oops. And so here are our results. This is the Western Hemisphere. And the red circles indicate areas where survival of the species is certain based on production of a lot of alates. The yellow triangles are areas where it's possible that it could survive. And in the white circles, it's going to be unlikely because it's just too cold. The lighter shading represents areas where there's enough precipitation, and the darker shading represents areas where it's too dry. So as you can see, in South America, there's a larger area than it currently exists in, so it could potentially expand its range there. Probably some of these other Solanopsis species may be, again, preventing it from doing so. Central America, the east and the west coast of Mexico, a lot of potential there. The Caribbean, a lot of islands in the Atlantic and Pacific. Here we have the Eastern Hemisphere. Mediterranean is at risk, where there's enough moisture. Central Africa. And there are places where there are no dots, and that just means we don't have good weather station data. India, Southeast Asia, down into Australia, Japan. There's a lot of places in the world, including Pacific Islands, where Invicta could survive if it could get there. Now there's another attempt to model the global potential current distribution of Invicta based on current climate, I should say. And this one used the Climax model. And it used a number of parameters, again, based on aspects of temperature and moisture, based on the range of the species in the US. And I'm not going to get into great detail about this one, but the results generally agree with our earlier simulation model, alate production. And unfortunately, they didn't publish their maps in color, and they didn't publish them very large, so this is the best you're going to find in the literature. But if you stare at it long and hard enough, you'll see that the results are qualitatively similar as to where Invicta could survive. So these two models are in fairly good agreement. Now, what about changing climate? Where can Invicta spread to if the climate changes, if it becomes warmer or even wetter? And we don't have any real global models on this, so I'm going to talk about some models for smaller areas. And one of these is in Oklahoma. There was a study done, and they looked at the suitability for survival of this species in the state of Oklahoma. They used the 510 millimeter precipitation threshold again, and air temperature. They used three different general circulation models. And on the upper left, you can see, here we go. This is what, under current conditions, the shaded area is where Invicta could currently survive. Up here, it's too cold for it. Here are the three models. And as you can see, they're expanding the range up to the border here. And the reason that they can't get out here under a climate change scenario is not because it's too cold anymore, but because it's too dry, okay? And the problem with this study, of course, is there's very little potential for them to increase their range just in the state of Oklahoma. And what we really want to know is how far north are they going to get? How far into Kansas are they going to get? And that wasn't really considered in this study. The second study looked at the presence of Invicta in the eastern U.S. and there was a logistic regression function created based on January mean minimum temperatures as a function of the probability of occurrence of Invicta. It was for the eastern U.S. only. They considered that there would be enough moisture. They didn't have to worry about rainfall. And they just said, well, how much expansion will occur if we get air temperatures increasing by 1 to 4 degrees? And it's not linked to any particular model of climate change. And here's the regression function. It's January mean minimum temperature on the x-axis here, and probability of occurrence of the fire ant on the y-axis. So it's a pretty good relationship. And just a summary of their results, here's the total area of infestation currently, and you can see how it's going to increase, predicted to increase, based on air temperature increases of 1 degree increments. And here's a percentage increase over the current area. So we're looking anywhere between 26 and 80% of an increase given these different changes in temperature. So those are large increases. So there's another model that I was involved in that, again, we used the simulation model of Karzukin et al. And we applied it to the southeastern US. And we based it on the VMAP climate change scenario. Again, we just considered the eastern U.S. and we decided it would be their precipitation will be suitable everywhere that we're applying this model. And our results were a lot more conservative. We got a 5% increase in the habitable area in 40 to 50 years, and then a 20% increase 80 to 90 years out. And let's see if I can make this go. No. Well, it's supposed to actually be a little movie that shows how the temperatures change over time. But basically, I can't get it to work here. But basically, what it does is it takes the previous about 100 years worth of data, and then it simulates the next 100 years of data based on a climate change scenario, and the temperatures that on the map are in blue represent cooler than long-term average, and reds are warmer than long-term average. And no, I can't go forward at all. There we go. So this is a couple of freeze frames from that movie. And the first one is 2045. And the second one is the year 2085. And you can see in 2045 in the southeastern US, air temperatures are predicted to be about a little less than 1 degree Celsius higher than they are now, mean annual maximum temperatures. Whereas in 2085, they're predicted to be 3 degrees or higher than they are now. So these are in the range of the figures in the study by Zavaleta and Roival, where they got 26 to 80% increases in range. We only got 5 to 20%. Here are our results. The black circles show the current potential range. The circles with a little dot show that the potential range 40 to 50 years out from, or well, 40 years out now. And the open circles, potential range about 80 years out. And then the crosses represent areas that are just still going to be too cold 80 years from now. And so why were our results more conservative than the other results based on that logistic regression? There's several possible explanations. One is that Zavaleta and Roival used a different western limit. They just said it was east of the Rocky Mountains, and we don't know exactly where that was. We had specific state boundaries, so it's a little different spatial area. I think some more important things were that they started with the current realized range of the species, whereas we started with the current potential range. There's some differences there. But also, I think the most important thing, they looked at the mean monthly temperatures. And the mean monthly temperatures really it's not what's going to kill the fire ant. It's going to be the coldest temperatures that occur during the year, which may only last for a few days when you have a very strong cold front push down. And so the mean monthly temperatures may mask these really short but intense periods of cold that are actually going to kill the fire ant. Now I wanted to contrast this with another species. So far with the fire ant, it looks like as the climate gets warmer, it's just going to continue to increase its range. There was an attempt to model the Argentine ant, and this was based on the GARP model. And they used a couple of climate data sets based on two general circulation models. And as with the fire ant, it predicted an expansion in higher latitudes, but there was a range retraction in the tropics. So the Argentine ant is a little bit more of a temperate species, and overall, it's predicted 11 to 15% reduction in the potential geographic range of this species over the whole world. So, given these climate change scenarios, the Argentine ant, the potential range for this species is supposed to decrease. Whereas with Solanopsis invicta, it's just going to keep increasing. Some of you have probably seen some version of this or another. And of course, all these models are not going to be correct in every detail. but some of them may be useful. The conclusions for this, I believe, they're fairly basic. There's a lot of potential for S. invicta to increase its spread throughout the world, even if there's no change in climate. And as the climate becomes warmer, it's going to be able to expand its range even more. And if the climate becomes wetter, it'll be able to expand its range even more in areas that are too dry now. The modeling efforts that have been focused on this species distribution in relation to climate change have so far been very limited in scope, and there hasn't been any real global modeling effort as far as I know. So there's potential here to do more of this sort of thing. Some of the challenges for future modeling efforts: there's a lot of different climate change scenarios and models out there. Which one do you use? Some of them are different enough, they may give you different results. And that's why a lot of the studies so far have used multiple climate change models. We also need a more reliable estimate of the how aridity affects the species. We need to have some data from a study. We need to figure out if seasonal distribution and precipitation is important or not. And also there's this issue of the finer scale microhabitat diversity. And mountainous areas, there may be a lot of difference between one valley and the mountainside as to whether the species can survive. In urbanized areas, temperatures are usually a few degrees warmer in the winter than in the outlying countryside. So the species may be able to survive around urban areas where it can't in the surrounding countryside and the northern limits of its range. Habitat disturbance, I think that's something that could be incorporated into the models. It certainly seems to be an important factor, and I think we're just learning now how important this may be for the species. And finally, there's this other Solanopsis species, the black imported fire ant, Solanopsis richteri, which is present in the U.S., and in the U.S. and in South America as well. It's at a higher latitude than the red imported fire ant, Solanopsis invicta. So if this species were to become invasive and travel around the world like invicta has, it might be able to occupy higher latitudes. And so this is something that needs to be taken into account. It's another potentially very invasive species. And that's all I have.
Okay. There's some time for questions for Lloyd.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the whole question.
Single species or range of species for the interaction with fire ants?
Are there any models that address how temperature change influences interactions between species?
Oh. The question is, are there any models that address how temperature changes the interactions of species rather than just a single species distribution? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. As far as I know, that there aren't any models that really look at those interactions directly, but that's a very good point, that you do have these interactions and they are important, and it really complicates the models, but that would be great to put those in there.
The physiological parameters are measured from the core of the species. Are there any differences as you move to the periphery of the species range and how they move with respect to the temperature?
Yeah, there are some studies that show in fire ants that species that it can adapt to colder temperatures and to drier temperatures, and if you get to the edge of its range, there is some short-term adaptation to some extent to colder or drier. Yeah, there's some evidence like that. And so for the models I've been talking about, we don't take that sort of variation into account. It's fairly small.
Okay, thanks again, Mike.
Okay.